WVUA-FM, Tuscaloosa.
Any opinions expressed in this program are those of the host and do not represent the thoughts or opinions of 90.7 WVUA or the University of Alabama.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to Season 3, Episode 2 of Pulse of the Nation. I'm Brandon Vick. I'm your host for the only politics podcast here at WVUA FM, and a lot of stuff has happened over the past week, so let's get right to it. First off, we had elections across the country last Tuesday, February 13th. There were about six special elections across the country. They happened in New York, they happened in Georgia, they happened in Oklahoma, and they happened in Pennsylvania as well. So let's start with the Georgia ones. And before I do, I do want to emphasize, this day of special elections was one of the weirdest, probably the weirdest special election day that I've had since I've been tracking this stuff. Been tracking this stuff for a couple of years now. And I have not seen a special election day that has been so decidedly mixed. Because if you just take a look at the Georgia results, you'd think Donald Trump was winning nationally by 30 points. And the reason I say that was because you had a couple of special elections, House District 125 and Senate District 30, which they are in, you know, exurban to rural areas, mostly in Georgia, some suburban areas, especially with House District 125 and in Columbia County in particular. And the Republicans massively overperformed. Now, granted, these are jungle primaries. Georgia has a system where, you know, in these, you know, with these elections, they have the jungle primaries. And if no one gets above 50%, then it heads to a runoff or something like that, at least in regards to federal races. I do not believe this exists for these local races where you can just win first past the post. But you have these jungle primaries that go ahead, they exist. And these deeply Democratic or deeply Republican districts, multiple members of the state party that's dominant in that district, they're going to run because they see an opportunity to win. There's usually only going to be one member of the opposite party, the minority party in that district, just so the party can say they put someone up. And that's what the Democratic Party did. I mean, clearly they had to, because otherwise you can't exactly explain the 30-point swing to the right at this special election that you got in Senate District 30. Otherwise, you cannot explain the near 48-point swing right in House District 125, you know, without giving up some of these factors. Like, if you just see this, I mean, if that replicated nationally, then Republicans would be in for probably the biggest landslide since the Great Depression. It's when, you know, FDR won nearly every state, you know, going up in 1932 and again in 1936. Like, this was weird, because you usually don't see swings of this caliber in special elections ever. And granted, do not take one special election as a harbinger that, you know, you're gonna see, you know, massive red swings or massive blue swings or anything like that. This is why we throw them in the average, because every special election has its own story to tell. But if you combine them, and right now we have 57 special elections in the time between the 2022 midterms and now when this podcast is getting updated and uploaded, that we have, you know, all these different stories combining together to create a national story. And if that had replicated even remotely nationally, then I would be up here exclaiming that, you know, Joe Biden and the Democrats are doomed, the Republicans are going to get a trifecta, and all this stuff, but I'm not. And the reasons why are, yes, throw it in the average, but also you have elections in Oklahoma and in Pennsylvania that we were tracking. We're going by as the polls close, and I notice that Oklahoma's House District 39, this is in West Edmond, this is north of Oklahoma City, has, you know, high religiosity, high college education rate. I believe a 51% of the district's population has a bachelor's degree or higher. And this district went from, in 2016, it voted for Trump by 33, in 2020 voted for Trump by 26. So it's a left-trending but Republican district. Here I'm seeing the Democrat pulling within near 5% of pulling off the upset in this district. I'm like, what is going on in Oklahoma? That's a 21-point swing left. And I'm like, how does this compute, first off, with the Georgia special elections? How does this compute with the national environment we're seeing from the polls? Because if you believe the national polls, Donald Trump is leading not just the Electoral College, but with the popular vote. And how do you reconcile the Pennsylvania House District 140? This is in Southern Bucks County. This House election determined who is going to have the majority in the state House of Representatives. Would Democrats continue to have it, or were the Republicans pull into a draw in House District 140? It's a Biden by 10 district. It was stagnant from 2016 to 2020. And the Democrat in the district goes up and wins by 35.5 points. And you have to just sit here and wonder, what were these other candidates doing to get such massive underperformances relative to the top of the ticket? This is a 25-point swing left. Like, if this anywhere close to replicates nationally in America's suburbs, then Biden's winning the Electoral College in a landslide. So you get all these conflicting factors, and you have a couple of things in New York. You have Assembly District 77 in the Bronx, which Republicans outperformed the partisan margin in a rapidly rightward trending district by 17 points. Now, granted, there are a lot of local conditions too. The Republican in this race was quite a liberal Republican. He's the head of some public housing unit in which, you know, this was also an extremely low turnout election, even for the Bronx. Dear God, only like 1,500 people voted in it or something crazy like that. But, and you shouldn't take one special election with about 1,500 votes cast as gospel for what the national trends are going to be. But it was still something interesting to watch. But the big thing that everybody was watching was the 3rd Congressional District in New York. A little bit of backstory about this. If you've been following any sort of politics, you'll know this is George Santos's district. George Santos won this district in 2022, flipping it from the Democratic Party as a result of a red wave that was striking New York at the time. This, you know, crime wave. Lee Zeldin was running. He was a Long Islander. Lee Zeldin got to about within 7% of flipping the governorship from the Democratic Party and didn't end up winning, but helped the New York Republicans win a lot of competitive House districts, a lot of competitive Assembly and Senate districts at the time. One of them was the 3rd Congressional District. That's the district that had gone from Clinton by 5 to Biden by 8 from 2016 to 2020. And now you see Republicans winning this by high single digits, by in the double digits even, as part of Long Island's, in particular, rightward shift over the time as it portends to not just crime, but also the migrant crisis, which Republicans in the state and nationally have seized upon. And, you know, thus Long Island has shifted rightward. It also has a very high Italian population, particularly in the south of the 3rd District around Massapequa, which, I mean, usually is Republican these days, but now has gone even more Republican because of this, you know, because of this crime wave. So the 3rd Congressional District, so George Santos, I think I've already said my piece on him in previous episodes on Pulse of the Nation. He got expelled, and thus you have a special election scheduled for February 13th. So what you have is that in New York, the local Democratic parties pick the candidates. So in this case, the Nassau County Democrats and the Nassau County GOPs. And I would say my piece about the Nassau County Democrats and Jay Jacobs, but that is for another time. But they ended up picking conservative Democrat Tom Suozzi. He's an Italian. So that obviously helps in a district like this. He has more conservative viewpoints in regards to immigration, in regards to the border. And the Republicans ended up putting up Mazzi Pilip. She's a black Nassau County legislator. And Republicans had hoped to make this an election about support for Israel. Pilip was a former IDF soldier, you know, Ethiopian Jew who migrated from, you know, to the United States. And they were looking to flip this district with her. But there are a few problems. For one, Suozzi's campaign was a lot more, I think, well-run than Pilip's campaign. Suozzi had, you know, a coherent message that he was running on, you know, sort of having his own brand. And that is, of course, certainly helped by the fact that, you know, he has a lot more name recognition in the district. People already know him. He was a former representative for this district until he retired to run for governor in 2022 against Kathy Hochul. I think he only ended up getting 10% or something in regards to the vote he got in the New York Democratic primary. So he had retired from that district, went to run the governor's race, flopped miserably, and Santos ended up flipping it. But he's back now, and he wants to get his old job back. And so he runs a pretty coherent campaign. Pillip runs a sort of disheveled campaign where I'm not even sure she knew which events were and weren't in her district. And when you're having to ask a major congressional candidate that's getting funded by a national party, that's when you know that the campaign is not exactly in the best straits. I mean, her last events of the cycle were all in the 4th congressional district, which is held by Republican Anthony Despacito. And if you're not holding your events in the 3rd district, the 3rd district is pretty big. Like, if as far as New York standards go, as far as Long Island standards go, you can't miss it. Like, it contains parts of Queens and the northern part of Nassau County. Like, I'm not sure how you can miss that if you're Motsi Pillip. But, what also didn't help was, you know, Motsi Pillip is a registered Democrat. Granted, this doesn't mean too much in Long Island, because there are a lot of registered Democrats who ended up voting Republican. You know, let's say the Persian Jews on Great Neck, for example. You know, a lot of them are registered Democrats, but they're put in the bank as Republican votes. But this draws in criticism from a lot of, you know, online conservatives. It's like, well, she's a registered Democrat. How can we rely on her to be a reliable conservative voice for the 3rd congressional district? And so there's not a lot of local enthusiasm behind Pillip. There's a lot of enthusiasm behind Swatsy. And what ends up happening in this race, which was polled as being very competitive, Swatsy was only up by a few points in the polls. And what ends up happening is that Swatsy ends up winning by about 8 points, by about the partisan lean of the 3rd congressional district at the time of the 2020 presidential election. Right now he's at 7.7%, which should be a slight underperformance of President Biden. However, we will maybe see when these late arriving mail ballots come in, maybe Swatsy adds to his margin, overperforms Joe Biden slightly. And he ends up winning very convincingly, you know, flipping the district to Democrats. And what does this mean first off for the House of Representatives? This is not good, obviously, for Speaker Mike Johnson. Last week, I talked about a lot of the problems that he's had with his caucus, and now that his House majority is going thinner, these problems are only going to be exacerbated. Had Tom Suozzi been there for the Mayorkas, for the second attempt at the Mayorkas impeachment, it would have failed. Because right now, where things are in the House, if the Republicans lose 3 votes, it's a tied vote, and the vote would fail because you need a majority in the House in order to pass anything. And Swatsy's Democratic vote is also not going to help Mike Johnson's rural vote problem, which, again, rural votes are being defeated at pretty historic rates, you know, in regards to this Congress as compared to other Congresses. And so Swatsy's addition is not exactly going to be the most welcome news to national Republicans who had spent millions of dollars on this district. However, they could not even come close to going ban for ban with the Democrats, which they spent even more. They spent about 63-64% of the money, you know, pretty much doubling up the Republicans in terms of spending and the TV time they were getting, because a lot of the difference in this race was Tom Suozzi was getting a lot more of the money himself than Motsi Pillip was getting. Like, Pillip was being funded more by National Republicans, the NRCC, than Swatsy was being funded by the DCCC. So the one thing to note about advertising is that candidates get a lot better rates on ads than like national groups do. And so when you have more of the money going to yourself personally, you're able to run more ads with less money. And this is especially important when you consider that New York City is probably the most expensive media market to run in. And you can't really focus your ads on a particular district. You have to run them nationally. Or at least like out and around the media market itself. So Swatsy gets a majority of the TV time. I mean, you also have, you know, some unforced errors by Motsi Phillip herself, what with the comments about Swazi being the godfather of the border crisis, which I thought was more hilarious than anything, just because, you know, you have, you know, Italian-American organizations and the Swazi campaign itself saying, hey, this is probably discriminatory against Italian Americans, especially considering, you know, Godfather and the Godfather movie and the connotations with Italian American mafia culture and whatnot. And so with that, with, you know, the debate performance being very good for Swazi, not so much for Phillip, you have a situation where, you know, Swazi wins, and thus, you know, another decent sign for Democrats. You know, even though the polls are saying that Biden is losing, what the elections have shown us is that right now we're looking at a similar environment to what we were looking at in 2020. And given what we've seen, I don't see any reason why the trends that we saw in 2020 wouldn't continue in 2024. With, you know, wider, more college-educated voters, more suburban voters shifting to Democrats. Meanwhile, you have, you know, you have less college-educated, more non-white voters shifting to the Republican Party, thanks to, you know, ideology, thanks to sort of religiosity being a huge factor, sort of, you know, overall, you know, social cultural issues of the time as well being a major factor in this as well. And this is a story that we are going to end up seeing play out over the next 9 months. You know, election day is 8 weeks in, or, well, if it was 8 weeks away, I will say that we'd be doing a lot more breathless coverage of the presidential election. You know, we'd have our nominees at this point. Conventions would have already passed. And this is a time where we would be breathlessly analyzing the polls. Where are the candidates at in the polls? Where are the parties at in regards to how they're performing in the special elections? And the story that this would be telling for 2024. Because at this point, if 8 weeks out from an election, the vast majority of people will have already decided who they're going to vote for. You know, the partisans on both sides are like, okay, yeah, I'm voting for my party's nominee. And we will be focusing on both campaigns' uses of their money. You know, are the Republicans going to be able to go ban for ban with Democrats? Right now, as I was talking about last week, right now they're not able to. Right now the Democrats have the money spread. And that is going to be something major to focus on as the Biden campaign, you know, right now we are 8 months, 3 weeks out from an election, looks to make up the polling gap. And there's going to be probably over $1 billion spent on this election. I would not be surprised to see that, you know, given how expensive elections have become, given the stakes of this election in regards to future American leadership and the other things that, you know, you would be focusing on at the time, the issues regarding abortion, issues regarding, you know, Donald Trump's legal cases, because as I've said earlier, you know, a lot of that money that Trump has been raising is going towards his legal fees. You know, the first of his trials is going to start with jury selection at the end of March, you know, about 40 days from now. You know, and that went up down in the news cycle. And to wrap off this segment, we don't know what's going to happen between now and election day. There's a lot of things that can go on, a lot of things that will end up changing the character of the race, who is favored, and for what reasons. One of those things that probably would have been if we weren't nearly 9 months out from a presidential election was the document situation regarding Joe Biden. This was one of the biggest stories in the news, and I promised last week I would get to this, and now here I am. We're gonna go for about half an hour on this, so bear with me. It's gonna be sort of a long ride. So I wanna focus first on the legal exoneration, because what Special Counsel Robert Hur ended up finding in his evidence is that he didn't have evidence beyond a reasonable doubt to charge Joe Biden with any crimes related to the documents. Because one thing to know about federal prosecutions more than anything is that they're not going to bring a case to trial. They're not going to bring a case before federal court if they're not absolutely 100% sure that they've got a slam dunk case. Like if there is any doubt that, you know, they might not be able to convict someone, based upon the evidence that they have. They're just not going to bring it up. And Robert here's job is to sort of explain in this report to Attorney General Merrick Garland, why are you not charging Biden? What is the evidence that you presented? What are some of the doubts you might have with the case going forward? Why are you not charging him? And so there were a multitude of reasons for this. You know, one was that, you know, for a lot of the cases where there were misplaced documents, they may not have been willfully misplaced. You know, the special counsel raises the possibility that that President Biden might not have known where these documents were going. You know, maybe the staff might have put that there without President Biden's knowledge. Maybe President Biden just sort of forgot that they were there, whether it was at the Biden home in Delaware, at the Penn Biden Center, or another place. You know, maybe in regards to the Afghanistan documents, which were classified at the time, you know, Robert here thought that, you know, there might be a case for the defense to make that President Biden thought that when he was vice president, that those documents were personal because they contained personal notes about then Vice President Biden's doubts about continuing to put troops on the ground in Afghanistan and his doubts about the United States even having a presence in the country. And he thought that the defense might have a case to make that would provide a reasonable doubt. And there are a lot of other things that Pierce said that essentially cast doubt on them ever being able to get a conviction for this case. But what was focused on in national reporting by media, by political pundits everywhere, was the part in the executive summary about Robert here sort of theorizing what the defense might for Biden might be. And the defense for Biden, Robert here theorized, they might say that President Biden was a well-meaning elderly man with a poor memory. And that is what was seized upon. And in some of the details about their memory, we all know, I think if we're following, we all know things about, okay, you didn't know when you were the year when you were vice president. You didn't know the year when, you know, Biden's son Beau died of cancer, you know, that President Biden believes was caused by the burn pits in Iraq in service of the US military. And some of the other details that were reported on in the media. But in regards to the memory itself, here support is mixed on that. Like, you have those details. You also have details about President Biden being able to have cogent and, you know, interviews where you could remember a lot of the events that happened at that time. And, you know, another thing to note is that President Biden, you know, two things. President Biden gave these interviews on October 8th and October 9th, the most recent ones. Remember, this is the case that goes back years, but the 2023 interviews were conducted on October 8th and October 9th. I have a theory that the events of the past few days in regards to, you know, Hamas conducting its attack into southern Israel and the IDF's response now going into today, they might have been on his mind. Like, President Biden had an international crisis to respond to. And that could be a possibility as to why maybe President Biden wasn't remembering things as he might have normally been. Because there may have been a lot of other things on his mind. Granted, there are always a lot of things on someone's mind in regards to being president of the United States, but they're usually not as urgent as one of America's major allies in the Middle East suffering, you know, the attack that Israel did on October 7th. And so maybe you say that might be a reason why Biden's memory in regards to the years that things might have happened might have been a little bit hazier than expected. The other thing to remember is that Biden sat in these interviews for several hours, about 3 to 5 hours, I think five hours combined on October 8th and October 9th. So granted, I mean, maybe his memory is not that hazy, but I mean, his interviews by the Hear report were cogent enough to where you sat there for, you know, several hours at a time, you know, giving the interviews to these, you know, to the DOJ's investigators. And so what was reported on the memory, that's what got national news. That's what got the national attention. And to say that the Democratic Party and its officials didn't exactly like what that Robert Heer was going on about Biden's memory is an understatement. Not so much so than President Biden himself, because he saw what, you know, Robert Heer said about Biden not remembering when Beau Biden died. And to say that Biden was ticked off is a massive, massive, massive understatement, because he ended up calling a press conference to respond to the allegations. So just to say, you know, that he thanks the DOJ for conducting an investigation, Biden was legally exonerated, but Joe Biden, what he said about Robert Heer, quote, how in the hell dare he mention, you know, the whole Beau Biden situation. That's what really, I think, got him emotional. That's what got him ticked off. There were reports that Biden had, you know, cussed out the report, you know, to House Democrats. Because at the same time when this report was given, being released, President Biden was attending a House Democrats retreat in Leesburg, Virginia, which is, you know, in the D.C. metro in Loudoun County. And so you have a situation where now Democrats are attacking a special counsel for what they believe are, you know, the term that they use is gratuitous. And granted, I think that's a term that that's a term that people like in the White House communications room and probably Joe Scarborough of Morning Joe ended up coming up with. But that's the term that they ended up running with, you know, in the days to come. Like, I really do have a theory that Joe Scarborough's use of the word really just sort of preceded Democrats using that word. Like, Democrats believed that Robert Heer talking about Biden's memory like that was not relevant to the investigation at hand. And they believe that over these couple of days, that this was a Comey-like political hit job. Now, James Comey, now what they're saying about the Comey thing in 2016 in regards to Clinton's emails, Democrats will tell you, you know, Democratic officials will tell you that Comey couldn't legally indict Clinton, so he decided as a Republican to politically indict, you know, the Democratic nominee for president at the time. They believe a similar thing is happening with Robert Heer. He was appointed by Donald Trump, you know, to the Department of Justice. He's a Trump-appointed attorney. And what this now boils down to is now a lot of Democrats think that Robert Heer was acting on the service of the political movement of which he is a part of, you know, in order to try and assist the Trump campaign in winning in 2024. Like, that is sort of the line. The line is that here's reports about Biden's memory or a political hit job. And Biden's press conference sort of alluded to, you know, his thoughts on that and Biden's issues with the national media in general, because Joe Biden and national media have not gotten along for a few decades. This goes back to when Joe Biden was serving the Senate, like in the 80s or something, even when he was running for president, you know, like three decades ago, you know, in his failed presidential campaign. I think going on to, I think, the plagiarism scandal that ended up sinking his campaign, there were reports that Biden might have plagiarized some college papers. And, you know, that ended up sinking his campaign. Biden's not liked the national media ever since. Clearly, that trickled down to his staff. And I think there is a story to be told about how President Biden dealt with the national media in that, you know, in that diplomatic meeting room, you know, in the Oval Office. He was a lot more combative against the national media and the reporters that were there than I've ever seen him. You know, like some of the lines that he gave to one reporter, I can't remember her name, but it was like, well, he's elderly, like he's 81 and he knows what he's doing, or something related to that, you know, just sort of pointed remarks to sort of say, hey, like, I'm an old man, I'm 81 years old, I'm well-meaning, but I know what I'm doing here. Like, trying to refute sort of the questions about his mental acuity that have dogged his campaign, that have dogged his presidency for, you know, the past couple of years now at this rate. And the other exchange that I remember vividly was one with Fox News reporter Peter Ducey. Now, Pete Ducey and Biden do not get along. Like, they have a mutual dislike of one another. And I think that was made very clear a couple of years ago when Joe Biden called Peter Ducey under his breath a stupid SOB. I can't say the full term because I'm pretty sure that would violate WVUAFM and or FCC guidelines. And I'll be honest, I want to make sure that this podcast remains on the air in its entirety. So we're going to go ahead and leave it like that. So in short, they don't like each other. Biden doesn't like Fox News. Democrats don't like Fox News because they believe, well, this is just a Republican media front organization. I mean, they don't believe that Fox News is a news organization. They believe it's a GOP propaganda outfit. And so that's where part of this distrust comes from. And so when Peter Ducey asked him a question, I mean, President Biden quipped the quote that his memory was so poor that he let Ducey speak. And that, I think, is kind of hilarious when I first heard it. I'm like, oh, Lord. Like, this just, again, shows that Biden does not like Peter Ducey. Pete Ducey doesn't like Biden. And I think it also, this episode just sort of reveals that now the Biden campaign, and this has been brewing for a while, like if you follow like Andrew Bates on Twitter, you know, and like other, you know, communications officials with the White House, with the Biden campaign, like they've had their issues with national media in the past, but to see it out in the open like this, I think goes into the sort of narrative that Joe Biden has had as like the comeback kid, as the person who always gets doubted, but and has to fight through in the end, sort of the underdog from the underground story, if you know WWE, similar to a Sami Zayn type of story. And that's the sort of narrative that Biden believes that he's been able to construct for himself. And that's a story that the Biden campaign has sort of run with. Sort of everyone doubts us. People don't think that we're going to be able to do this, but we go out and do it, prove everybody wrong. And that's this sort of episode kind of confirms that self-built narrative that the Biden campaign has, that, you know, the polls have Trump up and a lot of, you know, political pundits, mainstream analysts are saying, well, are questioning whether Biden can beat Trump. So it's this sort of spite against the national media that I think drives a lot of what a Biden campaign might do. Dude, like, spite against the doubters. Like, you don't think I can do this? Watch me go ahead and do it. Watch me prove you wrong. And that sort of attitude, it's been with Biden since the 90s. It's been with Biden since the 70s. Because remember, his first Senate campaign in 1972, I believe it was against a Republican incumbent senator by the name of J. Caleb Boggs. And Boggs was the favorite in that race. Nobody thought that a Newcastle County councilman was going to be able to go ahead and defeat, you know, J. Caleb Boggs. But Biden narrowly won that race. And he's been in federal elected office ever since, barring a 4-year break between 2017 and 2021. So this narrative has been built up for decades. And with this episode confirming it, President Biden and his campaign's media strategy is really interesting. And I have a few thoughts about this, is that they like to hit up local media because President Biden, he's been a politician for decades. He's a retail politician. He's cut from the cloth of going to a place and meeting the voters in person, sort of talking to them on the ground as they see fit. We've seen these episodes in like Superior, Wisconsin. We saw it in North Carolina. We've seen it in Detroit, Michigan as well, where President Biden wants to meet with the voters directly, meet with them one-on-one. I think this also happened in South Carolina where, you know, President Biden sort of ate dinner with this one family, you know, this one black family in South Carolina that I think ended up going viral on TikTok and on other social media sources. So Biden wants to speak to and build up sort of personal relationships with these voters, sort of looking them in the eye and say, hey, I've got your back. You know, you have a friend in me in the White House, that sort of thing. You know, telling them about, you know, what the administration has done in regards to unemployment, in regards to low black unemployment, in regards to, you know, labor rights, in regards to, you know, sort of the other accomplishments that President Biden will want to tout in, you know, his general election campaign. And I have a few questions about this. Chiefly, is that going to work in an age where all politics is national? Because I can understand wanting to focus on the 7 swing states you think you have the best shot at winning, in Nevada, in Arizona, Wisconsin, and Michigan, and Pennsylvania, and in North Carolina and Georgia. Like, I understand, you know, wanting to absolutely focus on those 7 swing states, because if you're not winning them, then you lost the election a long time ago. But in an era where local media is dying, in an era where local newspapers are getting either bought up by major corporations or are just flat out ceasing to exist because the people who own them are either unable to sell them to a local owner who can, you know, afford to run it at a loss, or they're running at so much of a loss that it simply wouldn't be feasible to run them. And as regards to local TV stations, most of them aren't locally owned. Like, they're owned by national corporations, Nexstar Media Group, Sinclair, are some of the ones that own Alabama news stations in particular. And so you have a situation where politics is more nationalized than it has ever been. And people don't, like, especially younger people, we are not picking up, you know, newspapers and reading them back in the olden days. We're going on our phones. We're looking at the news app we have in our iPhones. We're going on social media and we're getting news that way. And, you know, in regards to, you know, even the older people, like the local TV sources that you do get, they focus a lot on national news stories. Like Facebook news groups and, you know, getting it on Twitter, TikToks, and other, and YouTube. Like, people get their news from a lot more places now because we are so globalized. We are so interconnected now. And this isn't to say that Biden campaign hasn't recognized that. They're not running a campaign straight out of the 90s. They have a TikTok account. Like they have gotten over 100,000 followers, which I think they're at close to 3 times more followers there than they have in their campaign's Instagram account. I mean, the followers are still mostly on Twitter, let's be completely honest. But you know, they are going to be using TikTok. They're, you know, you're going to have, you know, Biden reaching out sort of these other media outlets through streaming services, you know, running ads there. You know, you're going to be running your general TV ads, but running your social media ads, running social media campaigns. And I will say that I believe, this is more opinion than analysis, I believe more so than ever, especially for the low info voters, that media shapes the narrative that voters are going to have. Media can either confirm it, what the voters are already thinking, or media can help sort of change perceptions. And it's just this sort of, you know, and it's this sort of, you know, media narratives that end up building up over years and years and years that, you know, could end up helping say, okay, you know, it's not just one newspaper, it's not just the New York Times, it's not just the Washington Post. It's things that get echoed in national media and things that get repeated over and over and over again until they stick in someone's mind. Those are the things that I think will end up going to shape what a voter thinks about when they end up voting in a primary, or how they end up voting in the general election more specifically. And it's the job of the Biden administration to create the positive media, because you have to operate under the assumption that the media narrative, they're not going to create positive media narratives for you. Like, the media is going to get the stories that get the most clicks, that end up, you know, bringing in the most money. Because, again, the news media is a profit-making industry now. Like, they're focused on being able to run, focused on being able to provide new products, being the biggest media conglomerate in the nation, biggest and best. So they're going to make decisions that, whether editorially or whether it's up top of the executives like David Soslov and, you know, sort of the others that have been helping running things at CNN recently, you know, you have a situation in which you're going to report on the stories that draw in the most eyeballs. You know, maybe it's not because they might not be the most newsworthy, but they're going to be the things that draw people the most. And, you know, concerns about Biden's age and sort of this concern reporting, that draws eyeballs, that draws readers, that draws clicks. And so you have to assume that negative reporting about Joe Biden is going to draw people in more than negative reporting about Trump, because we've had that for years. Even going back so far as 2015, when Trump actually first ran for the Republican nomination in 2016. Granted, there was a potential movement for Joe Biden to run in 2016, potentially. That would have been very interesting, considering some of the campaign themes he was going to hit on would have been very similar to Bernie Sanders in 2016, before Sanders sort of just rocketed up as a national figure in left-wing and in Democratic politics. So it would have been very interesting to see if Biden ran what he would have been running on, but that's a conversation for another time. The conversation you have to have right now if you're the Biden campaign is, you know, what news stories are you going to be able to create? How are you going to seize upon the opportunities that you have been given? Take the House Republicans, for example. They can't pass bills to save their lives. And are you able to seize upon that? Are you able to burrow that in a voter's head to say the Democrats are the party of governance and the Republicans are the party of chaos? They're trying to do that, but is it working? That will be something that we will be seeing over the next 9 months. If these efforts are working, that's a good sign for the Biden campaign. If they're not, ring the four alarm fires. If, you know, we're talking about the sort of impeachment processes of Alejandro Mayorkas and for Joe Biden, then those are other stories you could say about Republican Party's only focus in regards to passing stuff is to make political statements that Republicans usually would make. And like, you're not impeaching Alejandro Mayorkas for high crimes and misdemeanors. You're impeaching him for not implementing your preferred policy at the border. And you needed two tries to do it because you've gambled both times and you didn't know Al Green would be returning the first time. And the second time, you got lucky because Judy Chu, the Democratic representative from California, got COVID. If she didn't get COVID, that bill, that process would have died again in the House. And so you gambled twice and you got lucky on the second try. Like, that impeachment process is deader than dead in the Senate. And so if you're able to help burrow that in people's minds through MSNBC, you know, which is sort of a major liberal leading news outlet. You know, you go on CNN, you go on all these different, you know, national media outlets and sort of just keep telling people over and over again the narrative that you want the voters to have in their heads when they go out to the polls, then that will be the, that will be a part of the thoughts of the voter. It's like, okay, you're going to have concerns about Biden's age, concerns that he might not make it through his second term. But if you're able to also burrow in the voters' heads that, you know, what you want them to believe about the Republican Party, then they're going to be a lot more likely to hold their nose and vote for you. Because, you know, you might get them to think, oh, I don't want any of these candidates to be president, but given the choices that we have, I'd rather have person X than person Y. And if the campaign of person X is able to do that across the country, then you might be in a very good position to go ahead and win. The other thing I want to mention right now, and something that we'll go into much more detail in next week, is that the star witness for the House GOP's impeachment against Joe Biden, their attempted impeachment, Alexander Smirnoff, he was found by the Department of Justice to be making a lot of the story up, and he got charged by the Department of Justice for lying to investigators. I mean, granted, I don't exactly think it's the best situation for House Republicans to be in. If your star witness was found by the DOJ, was found by another Trump-appointed special counsel, mind you, to say, oh yeah, this guy's lying through his teeth. That does bring into question about what Representative James Comer, the Republican of Kentucky, is doing. And that is something that we'll be developing throughout the week. And that is something that, you know, we'll be talking about next week. So on to the conclusion of the my segment on the Here thing. He's going to be testifying on March 12th. It'll be nationally televised. And it's going to be going on in, you know, 3 to 4 weeks. That will be a very interesting story to tell. Once we get to that episode on that week, you know, and that episode would probably be coming out March 16th. So like exactly 1 month, right, like 1 month from now, pretty much on the dot. Like I'll be talking about what was said there. And sort of the political machinations at display and whether I think that here was doing what he did in order to politically indict Joe Biden. I'm not sure about that right now. There's a lot of things going for and against that line of thinking for me. But the only thing that I do know is that this not only accentuates concerns that the voters might have about Biden's age because it's national media repeating the same thing that they've repeated for months on repeat at this point, but this also might mark a shift towards the Biden campaign maybe being a bit more combative with the national media. It will be very interesting to see if they do, considering they admonished Donald Trump for, you know, also being combative with the national media, but it's something that we'll have to see in the months ahead because, as I said earlier in this episode, we have nearly 9 months to go before the presidential elections. One of the only good things for the Biden campaign about this report, this wasn't in September, this wasn't October, this was in February. And you have a lot of time to work on changing voter perceptions to the point where you would be in a favored position to win. And you have the money to do it. You're going to have the money to do it. You know, you're going to be able to have quite the money spread against the Republican Party in the 2024 elections. It's just, are you going to be able to use it? Because you have the money spread in 2016 and you still lost. I mean, the Republicans got a trifecta in 2016. You have to make sure that at the very least, the Republican Party isn't able to turn water into wine for the second presidential election in, you know, three tries. So that's all I'm going to say about this whole Robert Hur documents thing. We're going to go ahead and transition to some of the bills that the Alabama legislature, you know, has been advancing. So the first thing I want to talk about is Senate Bill 1. Garland Gudger, the Republican senator from Cullman, sort of introduced this, and it would essentially criminalize some forms of subsistence in absentee voting. You know, this, you know, ended up getting amended a little bit, but still largely the same bill that was originally filed. It passed the Senate on a strictly party line vote. I think 26-8, I believe, was the vote, with the Republicans in favor, Democrats against. Garland Gudger, you know, says that this is about, you know, election integrity, preventing voter fraud, and all that stuff. Democrats, you know, say that the Heritage Foundation, a conservative think tank, says that there's basically no voter fraud in Alabama. And they believe that, you know, this is an attack on, you know, older, more rural voters who, you know, might not be able to make it to the polls, whether it's because they might not have gas money, or whether they just might not be able to stand out there in that line, whether they might not be able to walk over there. And so, you know, when this bill becomes law, because this is going to become law, Governor Ivey supports it, and I see no reason for the House GOP to trash this bill, it will essentially be another restriction on the franchise in the state of Alabama. State that, by the way, absentee voting is not exactly the easiest. It's one of the hardest states to do absentee voting in. And this would only provide further restrictions upon an option which is already limited to so few Alabamians. There's also another Senate bill, a few Senate bills I'm going to get after. Senate Bill 4 is the thing that bans all non-like government flags from getting flown on public property. That's been delayed because like the original bill filed by Senator Gerald Allen from Tuscaloosa, like it got stricter, then it got delayed in committee for whatever reason. It's not advanced out of committee yet, but you know, over the next couple of weeks, we'll be tracking it. The state legislature resumes session on Tuesday, I believe. So they'll be been out of session for 5 days before they come back. So next week we'll probably have an update on Senate Bill 4. But critics of the bill say that this is only going to essentially ban pride flags being flown on public property, you know, without the consent of the owner of said public property, which, you know, that's going to be something that we'll be following in the weeks to come. Senate Bills 7 and Senate Bills 10. Also have something to do with, you know, Democratic critics of these bills saying that this is just an attack on local libraries in the case of Senate Bill 10 and the Alabama Department of Archives and History in Senate Bill 7 in, you know, acknowledging that queer people exist in Alabama and that Alabama does have an underrated queer history. And Senate Bill 7 essentially makes appointees at the Alabama Department of Archives and History serve at the pleasure of the governor, making them political appointees, pretty much, and allowing them to be fired at will, you know, and all this sort of stuff. That ended up, I believe, passing. Senate Bill 10 also did, you know, which would essentially allow local governments to fire library appointees. You know, again, Democratic critics think this is politicizing the whole issue. They believe that Republicans are trying to move towards book bans in certain areas, especially considering the conflicts we've seen in, you know, in Madison, in Prattville, in Foley, in Fairhope. You know, there's been this talk about what is and what isn't, you know, adult content, what is and isn't suitable for children. And it's a sort of fight that we've been seeing, you know, not for centuries, but it's definitely ramped up in regards to queer history and queer authorship in the past, you know, few years. And it's something that this, again, something we're going to be continuing to track, something that we're going to be continuing to follow, you know, in the weeks to come. Now, there has been something out of the House. It's not just the Senate that's been trying to legislate. There are a couple of House bills that ended up passing, I think 151 and 152. And these bills passed out of the House with, I believe, over half the Republican caucus in support and the entirety of the Democratic caucus in support of such a bill, which would essentially legalize gambling and open a state lottery in the state of Alabama. I think 151, which would establish the state lottery, which would establish the legalization of sports betting and casino gaming, that passed on a 70-32 vote. And it was a similar passage for 152, which, you know, regards sort of the regulations in regards to this sort of thing, creating a gaming commission and whatnot. And what this bill does is put this up to a vote in November. The constitutional amendment, you know, which would legalize this sort of thing, put it up to the people of Alabama. It's up to the Senate now. And the interesting thing about this gambling thing, it's usually with the state lottery, it's like it's passed the Senate, but it's not been able to pass the House. Now it's passed the House. Advocates on both sides, whether you're Democrat or Republican, if you're advocating for this sort of thing, you're hoping that, you know, it could pass the Senate. The governor supports these bills. And, you know, maybe, you know, Alabama can join a lot of the rest of the states in having a state lottery, because I can tell you from experience, you know, people go to Mississippi and Florida to play a lottery, especially where I'm from, you know, from Mobile County. People go to Mississippi all the time, not just to grocery shop, especially where I'm from in Grand Bay, but, you know, go play the lottery. When you're taking your vacations to Pensacola or to Disney World, you play the lottery there because you don't have that option in the state of Alabama. Maybe by this time next year, when this begins year, we might have that option. Who knows? But that's just sort of the update I wanted to give on the Alabama legislature. And I'm going to go ahead and end this off with redistricting. Yes, there's been more redistricting news. I'm not going to focus on the New York stuff because, let's be honest, the map that was proposed by the Independent Redistricting Commission is getting tossed by the House and Senate legislative Democrats. I should say assembly, because New York has an assembly and not a House. But they're getting tossed because Democrats are trying to fight fire with fire. Like, let's be honest, they're trying to gerrymander the state even more than it already is. They're trying to draw out a lot of Republican representatives in order to cancel out what the Republicans have done in North Carolina. It's just a brazen power grab. But that's the justification they'll give. They'll give a justification about, like, upstate people needing better representation and whatnot. But I think everyone knows. Like, these the Democrats know that they are trying to draw Republicans. But they view it as sort of, hey, if North Carolina Republicans can do it, then we can do the same thing. I want to focus on Wisconsin, because there's been a couple of interesting developments that have gone on in this case. So I believe I've discussed earlier that, you know, the state legislative maps were ruled, you know, against Wisconsin's state constitution, a 4-3 vote, partisan lines. And so they sent it back to the legislature to make new maps. But they also recommended, you know, an outside agency say, hey, you know, look at all these different proposals and tell us which ones we best suited to be constitutionally eligible. As far as the different requirements, which, you know, considers, you know, fairness, you know, VRA, which proportionality, you know, compactness. They view all the proposals by certain Democrats and Democratic affiliated groups as not being that different from one another. They viewed the two Republican maps as just being stealth gerrymanders, especially the one from one of the outside groups. I was like, hey, this looks clean, but this is still a partisan gerrymander in favor of the Republican Party. So the legislative Republicans, because Wisconsin's legislature is controlled by Republicans. Ever since Scott Walker came in, they did a red map. They gerrymandered the state to, oh Lord, like those maps are not pretty and completely gerrymandered. Like 2018, like a lot of people who follow politics will know, like, oh, Democrats won the popular vote in the Wisconsin legislature very easily, but Republicans got like 63 seats compared to Democrats 35 or something like that. Like, that's the sort of thing that you're able to see. And, you know, as far as Wisconsin goes, they've not exactly had a full democracy in their state government for a while now. And a lot of people are now trying to change that. Wisconsin Supreme Court is trying to change that. And Robin Voss, the Speaker of the House, the Wisconsin State House, you see the writing on the wall. And they're like, okay, they're going to try and pass Tony Evers' maps because those are the maps out of any Democratic-backed map that are most favorable to Republicans, to where Republicans could still maybe win a – could still be favored to win a majority in the state house. Like, you would have all these competitive districts that Democrats would have to go inch perfect in order to get a majority. And the Republicans think, okay, we can fight them on that. And so the Republicans are like, okay, we're going to go ahead and pass these maps. And Democrats are like, you've not been fighting for Fairmount for all this time, and now you want to pass Evers' maps? That's why a lot of Democrats voted against it. Like, pretty much all but a few did. Because they're like, okay, they think this is just a ploy to say, okay, these maps are passed, then Wisconsin Republicans would immediately sue and try to get them delayed for the 2024 elections. And so there is a push now by Democrats to say, hey, like, this is just Robin Voss trying to play his dirty tricks again. Please veto these maps, Tony Evers. I know these are your own, but please let the court decide. Because they believe that the courts would give a map that would be more favorable to Democrats and would allow Democrats a very good opportunity to flip the state house and to flip the state senate, you know, in particular. And so that's where we are right now. I'm recording this at a time where we just got news that this is not related to anything that we've been discussing, but I do want to give this news and sort of a live reaction that Alexei Navalny has died in prison, according to the prison service of Russia. He was an opposition politician that he's just been jailed. He had been serving sentences in a penal colony. This is to the Wall Street Journal. He'd been serving in the penal colony amounting to more than 30 years on various charges. You know, he's been subject to like torture from the Russian government and all this stuff. He had died at 47 years old. According to the Russian news agency TASS, the cause of his death was still being established. We're probably going to find out that, you know, he was probably beaten or poisoned to death or something like that, or he died of starvation or something, or any of these other issues that, you know, often happens in Russian prisons, especially considering the political prisoners. But yeah, just wanted to give my live reaction on that because that news just broke as I was about to end this podcast. But yeah, just a little quick reaction there. That Alexei Navalny, the most famous Russian opposition politician who has been jailed for his opposition, has now passed away at the age of 47. So we're going to be finding a lot more probably in the weeks to come, in the hours to come. You know, by the time this podcast gets released, we might know how Navalny died. But this has been Season 3, Episode 2 of Pulse of the Nation. We'll be back every week. We'll be back every Saturday at 4 p.m. to publish everything, all the happenings in local, state, and national politics over the course of a week. I'm Brandon Vick, and this is the Pulse of the Nation.
Any opinions expressed in this program are those of the host and do not represent the thoughts or opinions of 90.7 WVUA or the University of Alabama.
WVUA-FM, Tuscaloosa.